From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam.
Hello and welcome to another Eddie's Fast Facts episode. Today, we're pondering the changing face of mobility. How is mobility evolving, and what is this evolution doing for people's perception of travel? That voice you just heard was Carl Sagan, the famous American astronomer and writer. In that audio, Carl talks about the photo taken by the Voyager 1 satellite as it sped out of our solar system in 1990, and then it looked back to view the Earth as nothing more than a pale blue dot. This, of course, contrasts with how he viewed the Earth up until this point. That is vast, expansive, and infinite. This phenomenon can be described as the overview effect, and it's an experience of profound response and shift of cosmic perception that's reported to have been felt by several astronauts who've journeyed to space. NASA describes it as a feeling of awe for our home planet and the sense of responsibility for taking care of it. Early this year, I interviewed Jane Pointer, and we discussed how her company, Space Perspectives, will offer rides to space in their cutting-edge spaceship, Neptune, to anyone who's willing to purchase a ticket. The idea of the overview effect and the pale blue dot is one of the many things Jane and I discussed when I spoke to her, and she likened it to her experience of living in Biosphere 2 for 2 years, and also spoke about her desire for Space Perspective to be able to offer this experience to many more people.
It actually goes all the way back to my days in Biosphere 2. So Tabor McCallum and I, my co-founder and I, were involved in a project back in the early 90s. Actually, we were on the design team in the 80s and then lived in it in the early 90s for 2 years and 20 minutes, though who's counting? And just to remind us all what Biosphere 2 was, it at the time was sealed tighter than the International Space Station. It was the very first time that we, humanity, attempted to build the world's first human-made biosphere. It was called Biosphere 2 because, you know, the idea being that planet Earth, our biosphere on the planet, is Biosphere 1. And so we lived inside there, and all of our oxygen was coming from the plants around us. We knew moment to moment that our CO2 was going out to grow our food. You know, we could see the edges of our world with that glass and steel structure around us. And it was really interesting, right? So I went into the biosphere thinking that this was the closest thing that I'm ever get to going to Mars. I went there because I thought it was about going to space. And when I went in, I realized it was also about discovering a planetary biosphere that we all inhabit together. And it turns out that that is a very akin experience to that which astronauts have when they see Earth from space. And what it does is when the astronauts see Earth in space, right, they see that thin blue line of our atmosphere. They see the Earth against the blackness of space. And they get this visceral understanding that we live together as a human family on planet Earth. So this experience actually creates a response that makes one actively, proactively want to solve the grand challenges of today. So it is absolutely at the core of what we're doing at Space Perspective, wanting to take thousands of people up to have that experience and, you know, do something amazing with that experience.
So what do you think would happen if the overview effect became something experienced not just by astronauts, but by anyone with a ticket aboard Spaceship Neptune? What power could this sort of cognitive disruption unleash? And what could it mean for the future of our planet and humankind? Would it inspire a greater sense of urgency when it comes to protecting the planet and all those that inhabit it? Would CEOs change how they balance environmentalism, humanitarianism, and profit? What would it mean for space exploration? Will those that have been to space feel some sort of visceral connection to it? Would it be strong enough for these individuals to want to inhabit other planets like Mars?
I want us all to be going, right? I don't want it just to be for the few scientists, for the few astronauts, that eventually we're going to have hotels, we're going to have people living on the moon, and that's super exciting. And that is going to happen before we have people really living long-term on Mars, simply because it's so far away and difficult to get to. And I think that's super exciting. Not because I want us to be leaving planet Earth, but because I think these explorations, these outposts, they bring us things that otherwise could not happen here on Earth, right? I mean, there's the reason why the great navigators explored our world initially, our planet that seemed so huge initially. Now our solar system seems so huge. Now imagine if we're going out and all of those people will be looking back at Earth and having that space perspective, and in increasing amount, the further you get away, right? You get that little tiny experience of the pale blue dot that Carl Sagan spoke about when he took that image of Earth from the edge of our solar system in the 90s. I mean, wow, that was an iconic image. So I think it's very exciting and will definitely happen. Can I tell you when? Probably not.
What do you think is the biggest difference between an environment on the moon or on Mars, let's just say, wherever, outside of Earth, the difference between an environment that holds you just for a short visit, say for 6 days, versus one where people could live there permanently, born, live out your life in this new place? What's the biggest difference between those two environments?
When you see bases that are currently designed for people to live on the moon or Mars, it really feels like something that you could go for a while. But I don't know about you, but it doesn't feel like it's somewhere where I would feel like is home. We need to be building for the long term. We need to be building places that feel like home. And that doesn't just mean, oh, I'm going to have a more comfortable chair to sit on when I'm on the moon or Mars. It's like, oh, we need to take our biosphere with us. You'll see we have like a little smidgen nod to that in Spaceship Neptune. We have some plants inside Spaceship Neptune because it is a nod to the fact that we don't thrive without other life with us. And so going to somewhere like the moon or eventually Mars, we have to take that with us. We have to take our biosphere with us in many ways and put the human experience at the center of it. It's sort of the same way, right? When you think about space travel as the way we've mostly thought about it, it's the right stuff. It's like, I'm going to put up with the discomfort. It's hero stuff. Well, there's only so many of us that are born to be heroes. Let's just face it. If we're going to go live there, it has to be something we have to change the paradigm of that so that it really does feel like home and somewhere we can not just survive, but thrive.
So imagine you're planning your next vacation. The last holiday you took was to the beach. The time before that, you were hiking in the mountains. This time, you're looking for something a bit different. Well, how about booking a ticket to space? Space Perspectives is one of several space exploration companies offering tickets to the general public. True, fees may be a little high right now, but pricing will likely decrease as these trips become more commonplace. So what impact will this have on shaping commercial travel in the future?
One of the things we talk a lot about with Spaceship Neptune, right, It doesn't really require training. It's a very gentle experience. It's a very accessible experience, right? I mean, if you can get on a commercial airline, you can get on Spaceship Neptune. That's what this space balloon affords us. But now that means we can take anyone to space, but they need to be prepared for it. It seats 8 customers, explorers, as we call our customers, 8 explorers and a captain. Mind you, the captain does not have a whole lot to do. So the vehicle can fly itself. It can be flown for mission control on the ground. And then there's another mission control on the ship. So really, the captain is there just to make sure everybody is, you know, super comfortable and got everything they need in curating this experience. So it is 16 feet in diameter. And so it's roomy. You can get up and walk around and go stand at the bar. You can cheers in the middle. This is exactly the opposite of how we normally think of a space flight. That's the unlock here. That's what's really making this so accessible. You know, and then we're also adding on our own sort of reimagined way of experience based on top of that. So the capsule itself, you don't have high Gs. You don't need to be wearing a fancy spacesuit or do all the training or any of that. This is absolutely gentle. You're in a pressurized capsule with your beverage of choice and your loved ones, and you're heading to space. I mean, it is just completely different experience. For us, it's about discovery. People are going to space to discover something new. And in this instance, it's a completely different perspective. It's the space perspective, right? That's why we call it the company Space Perspective. That ultimately is what we're offering people. And it is. We want people to go into this with that stance of exploration, discovery. The demand for this is huge. What is actually limiting the number of people that are going to space is by no means demand. It is how many operators there are. So because there's so few operators, this is going to be supply side limited for many years to come, which is actually a great place for us as a business to be in. So the way we think about it is that rising tide floats all boats. We are not in competition with Blue Origin and Virgin, and certainly not Axiom or SpaceX, right? It's very different experiences.
I want to go back to the cost, $125,000. And so the first thing I did is I go, wonder what is the most expensive airline ticket you could buy? And what I found was that for $30,000 on, I think it's an airline from the Middle East, you can have your own like mini apartment with a shower. I suppose it's on a 747 or a very large wide body aircraft, $30,000. So you're getting close, right? I mean, it's a factor of 4. It's not a factor of 10 or 100 compared to the most expensive airline ticket that's out there. What do you think has to happen to get that 125 down to, you know, it's like a ticket from London to LA or something like a business class seat, or, you know, get it down to 10K or 5K.
Yeah, no, I think you're raising all kinds of interesting points. So first of all, when we set the ticket price, we actually looked a lot at what's happening in the luxury travel industry, right? So people go on these beautiful safaris, you go to the Antarctic, go on a plane flight, you know, around the world. That's all in their area of $100,000 to $200,000. So we're right in there with what you might call the luxury travel industry. And so, you know, the way we think about it is, you know, how exciting it would be for people to be sort of sitting around the dining room table thinking about, well, are we going to go to on another safari? Are we going to go see the Northern Lights, kind of done that? Or are we going to go to space? So we've in many ways sort of created a new destination for people to think about going to. So that's incredibly exciting. And the demand is so huge, Ed, that it is likely that the ticket prices are going to go up before they're going to go down. However, having said that, we are obviously, of course, thinking about what it would take over the long run to bring prices down. And, you know, I think eventually they will come down. You know, we're thinking about tiered products. I don't know that the higher end one will go away. But, you know, it's about scale. It's about getting a lot of people flying. When you're only flying a handful of people a year, as is really currently happening, it's going to be very difficult to get the prices down. But once you've got thousands of people flying to space, that's when you're going to start seeing the prices really rocket down. I mean, they've already come down a lot over the last years. If you think about just the price of rocket launches, I'm not talking necessarily space travel per se, but rocket launches. And then the same thing will happen just with efficiency of scale as we start flying more and more people to space.
As is evidently clear, mobility is in a dynamic phase. We're experiencing major shifts and redefining the way we travel, where we travel to, and, perhaps more importantly, how travel changes our perspectives and inspires our ideas. So what does the future hold? What new heights will we reach and how long will it take to reach them? These are burning questions that only the future can answer. I'm just happy to be along for the ride.